Energy Stew with Peter Roth, Thursdays at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host. And we're going to climb back into an ancient book of wisdom and knowledge and support, actually. It's an incredible book to not only read once, but I've just gone through it again, and I'm so inspired by it. And I'm so glad to have the author of this book. It's not actually the original. He's written the most up-to-date version of it, and helpful to all of us to be able to read it. And that's Jack Hawley. Jack, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Peter. I'm glad to be back.
Yeah, and I'm glad you could make it. And we're talking about the Bhagavad Gita, and we did have a show about this not long ago, and explained that in its original form, and a lot of millions of people, hundreds of millions of people have tried to read it, not all successfully, because it needed your interpretation. I think for us to be able to grasp it in our modern minds, it took a walkthrough by you to show us how to hold the truths of it.
Well, thank you, Peter, for that. Actually, I'm one of many, but I'm delighted that this book turned out the way it did. It's really been a blessing for us too, for me and my wife.
I'm sure. And for me also, I've just gone through it a second time. Actually, I took shortcuts because I did a lot of underlining and dog-earing pages and doing all kinds of things to pull out what I thought were the essences. And I mean, there's so many of them, it's practically reading the whole book, but everything I read this time just went right to my heart and to my aha.
Oh, you know? Wonderful.
And it's great to have something that you realize, even though this is many thousands of years old, how so current it is.
Isn't it amazing? To look back in history in a straight line, 8,000 years in that culture. 8,000 years, that's not long after the last ice age, Peter. And to look back that far and to see it as totally relevant today, it's just amazing to me always, and it always will be, I hope.
Right, and you know, some people are going to argue about how old it is, but even if it's, even if people can accept that it's only 3,000 or 4,000 years old,
okay, yeah,
you know, we won't argue about that. I after the last show, I had some criticism as to how old this book might be, and not everybody can agree with these ages.
Right, that's right. Nobody, as a matter of fact, all the scholars are in total disagreement about how old the book is. And it ranges from, 8,000 or, even older than that, up to maybe as recent as 1,000 or 1,100 years old or so. But I tell a story and I have a smile on my face when I tell it, but I say that, I've often wondered how old it actually was, and I met a man, and this is a true story, by the way. I met a man in India who was there during the period of this war, and that was in the year 3141 BCE. So that puts it at 3,000 years before
plus 2,000.
Our Christian era.
Right. And he was actually there. He was a very old man when you met him.
He was sort of an old fellow, yes.
Uh-huh. That's quite curious. And certainly, I believe, in past lifetimes, so we all could have been there.
That's a good point. And I think your excitement about this and your taking to it so readily probably indicates that you were somewhere in the vicinity of those original teachings too, Peter.
Perhaps. I know my last lifetime was in India.
Oh, okay.
I was a disciple of of Sri Ramakrishna.
Uh-huh. Oh, how wonderful.
Yeah.
I love him. Yeah, I've read a lot of Ramakrishna.
I actually did a past life regression hypnotically and got to even see what I look like.
Oh, very interesting.
Yeah, it was very clear. And so I do have an affinity to India, and this certainly is the wisest, this book, the Bhagavad Gita, is a is so true to what almost every modern book tries to teach us about wisdom, and help us hold on to our souls.
Yes, it's let me talk a little bit about some of the main teachings.
Sure.
This will, you know, risk being redundant, but there, as I look at it from my angle, and by the way, I had to finally go through because I got the assignment to do it, and I sort of pushed back against it. My guru, Satya Sai Baba, was telling me, "Please, you do this," and I kept saying, "I can't do this, Swami. I'm a Westerner. I'm a regular, normal guy from the USA. Worldly, too worldly. I don't know Krishna. I don't know any of the mythology and the background and the teachings of ancient India." And he said, "You do it. He kept after me. You do it. You do it." Finally, when I gave up, of course, the universe moved too. As soon as I said, "Well, okay, I will do it," then everything came my way. And by everything, I mean books would people would stop me on the street and give me books on the Bhagavad Gita. And these are ancient, or some of them ancient, some of them relatively modern, relatively within the last century, books that explained what the teachings were of this ancient most scripture. So I ended up, Peter, with over 40,000 pages of commentary on the Bhagavad Gita. So and the reason I did that is because I had to be meticulous. I knew that being a Westerner and writing these great teachings, I had to know what I was talking about. So I overdid it a little bit, but every one of those 40,000 pages were really awfully enjoyable for me. And it became part of my life. You know, getting that deeply into it, suddenly I became it and it became me. And it was just a very nice kind of a super spiritualization of my life also. And my wife's too. She was along with every one of those pages practically.
But let's just say that even though it was so complicated to wade through all of this material, the teachings, it's not like if you pick up this book, you have to undergo this huge, complicated teaching.
Oh, am I glad to hear you say that. That's right.
It's quite simple.
Yeah.
It gets to the point.
Yeah, and you know what, too, is the gift that I was given is that it ended up, the whole book ended up at 168 pages, actually, the teachings. And that's from 40,000 pages of various commentary on it. And one of the messages I got early in the writing was the message that came into my mind very clearly is Krishna can stand on his own two feet. And I thought, what does that mean? And slowly I realized as I continued working, it meant that this had to be a unique Bhagavad Gita. It had to be one that doesn't comment on the teachings, but it gives the teachings in a straightforward way.
So, I like that. In other words, the teachings have to stand on their own two feet.
Yes, that's right. They have to, and I liked it too, and ended up much shorter and a lot clearer, a lot more concise, and I worried about the correctness of it because I'm a Westerner, and I watched carefully the Sanskrit scholars in India and their reaction to it, which I'm very gratified to say has been universally positive. So, except for some people who would argue with the dates, and I have fun with that, by the way. I'm not at all concerned.
Right, but people think differently and hold things in different ways. And there might be some people who are much more conservative or traditional and want that kind of approach. But I think that you're thinking of us Westerners who want to hold this in a way that's heartful rather than mindful.
Uh-huh.
And even though there's a lot to think about, if your heart doesn't register it, it's not worth paying attention to.
Oh, isn't that good? And so the center of the whole thing is really the heart.
Sure. And it is because, you know, I'm a counselor to many people. I'm an intuitive counselor.
Yes,
and I have people coming to me all the time. And it's like, you know, their troubles are all, you know, as superficial as they seem on the surface. In other words, on the surface of life, so many issues having to do with life itself. What the true issue is where their heart is at or not.
And
what they can hold about it. Because one of the teachings in the book is to be able to surrender and trust the process. And understand that our opinions really don't amount to a whole lot because we don't know enough. And we'll never know enough. And so each moment is a new moment that comes from the unknown. And we're either in it or we're not.
And a way to get in it is a cornerstone method is that surrendering, just like you're saying. It's just let go of it and finally give it over to that higher energy, power, entity, whatever we want to call it, that's in us anyway.
Right, and there's so much in this book about false judgment. You know, in other words, we can keep on judging, but we don't know.
I know. That's where we really don't know. Except at the very inner core of us, we know everything.
Well, that's what it's a lot about that I really love, because it's an honest book. It's an honest teaching because it allows you to be yourself. It doesn't say, okay, now become godly. Now become, and this is what we call godly. It's not like positioning you and packaging you as some religions might want to do.
Yeah, or you put it so nicely, too. I really appreciate that.
Well, thank you.
There's no preaching in it. There's a lot of teaching, a lot of information, but in the end, the narrator of the Bhagavad Gita tells us that we have to go off, not even tell anybody else about this. Just go off on our own, pick the parts of it that fit for us, and put them into our life and apply them and live a different, less painful, less fearful life because of having these teachings inside of us.
And it also says that you're only human and you're not going to be perfect, so give it up.
Okay, good.
That's another surrender. It's
right.
Surrendering to keep bumping into ourselves and life. Mm-hmm. And we constantly do. So that's why it's good to have an inspiration that reminds you that you don't know any better. And so what you're making out of something is what you're making out of it.
That's right.
And it might be very relative to what you think is a moment, but in the long run, it's not working on solid ground.
That's right. And once we get out of our own way, once we get out of our own way in terms of, well, let's say, overthinking something or being overly concerned with it or overly evaluative or whatever. Once we get out of our own way, our own thinking way, get into our heart, get into our center, then things change. Things change. The main thing that changes, Peter, by the way, is mind. So here's an 8,000-year-old set of teachings. By the way, the book itself isn't. The writing of it is probably more like 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000.
Right. It was passed down by word.
Yes, it was passed down by word of mouth. But the teachings are full of psychology. This is before psychology was even thought of. They're full of this kind of deep inner wisdom.
Right.
And that's always been amazing to me.
It talks about personality types.
Oh, yeah. It even gets into that's right. And at first I thought, oh, how quaint, getting into personality types, until after I was in it for a while, realizing the three different personality types laid out in the Gita are really a full and complete system of thought relative to human behavior.
Right. They're underlying attitudes of mind that shape us.
That's right.
And we probably aren't any one of them. We're probably a combination of different percentages
of
them.
Yes, that's right. Always. And they'll shift from day to day, too. We'll be a certain percentage of one and not of the other and so forth. So we're constantly in motion inside of us. and constantly changing and constantly learning. And it's that's just, you know, a deep, deep system of thinking about human behavior that was fascinating for me.
Right. And to me, one of the most profound things is allowing oneself to be true to one's nature, even if it's in disagreement with everyone else, because that's what your true nature is.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I work with the human design system, which uses planets and the Chinese I Ching. And it really identifies everybody in very specific ways.
Oh,
so that if we want to know what our true nature is, we can certainly look at our human design, and it explains it. And one example, I was surprised last week that I looked at the design of Ayn Rand. A-Y-N, Rand.
Yes.
She was a famous writer of the last century.
Yeah.
She wrote the book Atlas Shrugged. And now the Republican Party is using her as a heroine, that she's their model.
Mm-hmm.
But she has a trait, and I've even heard her in an interview saying that to help the poor and disabled is actually evil.
Mm-hmm.
And she uses those words. And so I looked at her chart, and the first trait that shows up in her chart, and this is computer-driven, I mean, this is mechanical, is that she has no use for any dependency or interdependency.
Mm-hmm.
Totally,
oh, very interesting.
Totally uninterested in any value of any relationship. So how could anyone like that relate to people's needs, other people's needs?
Yeah.
So
you know, a friend, I take it back. I was invited to a meeting of well-known psychologists throughout the country. This is maybe 20 years ago. And a fellow was there who lived with her. Here was her live-in friend for a number of years. And people asked him a lot about her teachings. And he was very articulate about them, but he also said there's one thing missing. And the thing that was missing is deep love.
Uh-huh.
That's interesting. I don't know how that fits with your chart.
Yeah, well, no, but what I'm getting at is that here's somebody who some people might be in agreement with, but a lot of people would be in disagreement with her attitudes.
Mm-hmm.
And yet she was living her true nature. So if she can live her true nature, then, you know, I've looked at the charts of many famous people, and some we might have great disagreement with, and yet their charts say that they have to be that way. They're here. That's the only language they know, is to be who they are, the way they are. You know, Glenn Beck has a design where he has the need to create public discontent. Now, you might say, well, no, that's not good, but maybe it is. See, this is all coming back to the Bhagavad Gita that says, trust the process. Everything is right in the universe, and we can't, you know, start breaking everything down and being the judge. We just have to surrender to the ultimate godliness in everyone.
That's right. Good. How nicely put, and also how nicely drawn into today's world. You're right. To leap to judgment is a leap too far.
Right, and that's so true for today's world, because there's so much that we can judge wrong,
and
many people too that we can judge wrong.
Yeah, and quickly. Once I was in India, and I was in a place where I wanted to get a better view. I was in a huge crowd. I wanted to get a better view, and nothing seemed to work. And I couldn't. Finally, I missed the whole show, and I was glum about it. So I went back to my room, and first of all, I stopped for a cup of tea on the way back, and I looked out in the street, and I saw a man kicking a dog and so forth. And it would be so easy in a mindset to leap to judgment about that. But a little voice came into my head, very small in the back of my mind, says, don't judge.
Right.
And I wondered about that. Don't judge. That was a new idea, a powerful kind of a thought. It was so powerful, I went back to my room, sat down actually against the wall. As I shut the shutters in my ashram room and sat down against the wall on the floor and thought about that. And I wanted to contemplate. Don't judge. Don't judge. And slowly but surely into my consciousness came that same voice, but it became more and more strong. And it said, you don't know. You really don't know. You can't. Oh, it said you have no license.
Well, you don't know all the stories around it.
That's right. You don't know what was happening.
Right.
And then and suddenly that foul mood that I was in, that sadness that I was in on that day, left me. As soon as I got into, I found a way to get beyond my judging, then my world changed, and everything in my mind changed once that stream of non-judgment came into it.
Although there are people who are born to judge, hopefully objectively, and if not, it's still what's proper for them. And we can't judge judgment.
Uh-huh.
So, in other words, every way we look at this, we have to give up.
Good. Very good. Although I know in that case, yes, I'm agreeing with you and adding. In that case, my getting through that natural judgment that we all have was like a great gift. It was a wonderful boon, and it stayed with me for all these years since. It's being, you know, getting past that quick negativity that seems so natural to us was terribly important for me in that situation, Peter, that I had to, it's real to me right now to this day, 20-some-odd years later.
Now, it doesn't mean that we can't make corrections as we go along. And so if we see things that we think can be corrected in some way, but also be humble about it because we don't know everything about it. We might be correcting something that's wrong. You know, for instance, they took the wolves out of Yellowstone.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought that was correct because the wolves were scaring people or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then they found out that without the wolves there, the forest disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, how about taking the wolves out of society in politics or whatever? I mean, what don't we know? And
right.
Maybe things are evolving exactly how they're supposed to.
Let's say this for sure.
Yeah, okay.
And it's perfect.
Right.
Really.
It's all perfect, and we don't know the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever it is perfect also.
Mm.
And that's the hardest thing, because we want to control things so much. And to give up control, I think, is getting to a much higher place.
Let me go back one time, because there's a little bit more learning, I think, that I can pull out
Please.
Of that little story that I
Please.
Told. That is, that man that I saw kicking the dog, and I was so quick to judge him, and then I got that message inside, don't judge. And then I went back through that whole contemplation of that and learned so much and felt so much better. Well, the next day, I met a friend of mine. We were sitting on the ground waiting for darshan, waiting for the holy man to come out. And I told him the story of how I got the message yesterday not to judge and so forth. He was very interested in it. He's a friend of mine from New Zealand. We did a lot of this kind of philosophical exchange. And then the fellow that kicked the dog walked by, and I nudged this friend of mine from New Zealand, and I said, that's the guy. That's the fellow that kicked the dog. And he looked at him, and then he looked at me after the man was out of hearing range. He said, don't you know him, Jack? I said, no. He said, that fellow has he's mentally disabled.
Oh.
I know. So, see, it would be so easy.
Right.
It would have been so easy for me to just snap to that judgment, continue that sadness that had started my day, and stay in that mood. When I cleared that out, then my day turned happy, and not only that, but then I got the further message the next day. Nice learning is that we don't know. We really
right.
don't know these things, and I think that's just underlining all the things that you're saying now, Peter. We just really don't know, and whether it's a Glenn Beck or an Ayn Rand or whatever, if we accept and if we surrender to the to the wisdom that's in the universe and that resides inside of us, then we're in a much better place, and our life can be far, far richer.
Right. And so all of these people who are out in the world who we might disapprove of, they're all following their own God's gift.
Yeah. Yes. Well, okay. Or they're following what they have to do.
Well, that's what I mean. In other words, that's the God spark in them of being true to their nature.
Yeah, I'm just snickering because I thought, gee, I'd really like to explain this to Glenn Beck, however.
Well, yeah. I think he might actually be able to understand it. I think there's a part of him that is somewhat has some loose screws, and other parts of him that I think are very wise.
Well, that's interesting. Do you think that that's maybe the basis of some of his popularity, too?
Yeah, I think people see that, you know, and even Sarah Palin in her chart has the Savior. And so a lot of people look at her and go, oh, she's going to save us. She's going to save us. You know, the people who think that she can, of course. Mm-hmm. But she's designed for a certain number of people to believe that in her.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So we're all here. Everybody, no matter whether you're famous or not, you have a God's gift. And you're here to be true to that. Just like Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita was here to be true to being the warrior, and he had to go to war, and Krishna gave him the approval for that, and why would God say go to war? I mean, if anything, God would say stop, just be at peace. But somehow everything is perfect the way it's unfolding, and eventually we hope that it all comes to peacefulness in the end. We would like to see that the purpose of humankind, I think, is to find wholeness and oneness and peacefulness.
Uh-huh.
So this is a book that it's a great journey toward that. I think there are a lot of other wisdoms in the book that perhaps at you know in a, at a later time we can come back to it and do a show that maybe focuses on particular truths that we can talk about from your book because there's so much that's inspiring and allowing. You know, this book allows, and it doesn't say you have to do this or you have to do that. It just explains what the opportunities are.
That's right, and you know I'm built that way too. I think the reason I got the message to work so hard on getting this book to the West, bringing it home in a way, is because my own proclivity is absolutely not to do any missionary work whatsoever. There's not a missionary bone in my body, so I do get great enjoyment out of bringing ideas, bringing information. I have no need, and this is just the way I'm built, I have no need to change anyone.
Well, I wonder how many people will pick up the book if they can't read it, if it's not in their nature to read it. So you're not going to change those people. They're not going to pick it up.
Good.
So let's just look at the title here, The Bhagavad Gita, A Walkthrough for Westerners. So it really is very user-friendly. It's a wonderful read. I recommend it to a lot of people, not only on the show but privately. I've suggested to so many people that they read the book. It's so not only inspiring, but it just helps you get through each day too, because it allows you to get into that place of surrender and being open-minded. So Jack Hawley now, Jack, H-A-W-L-E-Y, how can people reach you?
Well, I think the best way would be to go to my website. And it's thegitawalkthrough.com, it's all one word, gitawalkthrough.com. And it's spelled all out, walkthrough is T-H-R-O-U-G-H rather than any of the new ways we have of saying that. So it's thegitawalkthrough.com. And also, there's something else that's coming out now, Peter. I'm just delighted. Since the last time we talked, my publisher called me, and he said, Jack, he said, I just read, or just heard, rather, I've been listening to a CD that I made a year or so ago of the Gita. And what I did is I read this into in a sound studio in Hollywood. A friend of mine owns it. He had his engineer do a CD, an MP3 version CD, all in one package, of me reading 5.5 hours worth of the Bhagavad Gita.
Wow, that's great. Congratulations.
Well, it turned out nice, and the publisher said, gosh, I love this. He said, this is a masterpiece, Jack.
Oh, good. Well, thank you, and thank you so much for being a guest on Energy Stew, and hopefully you'll be back again sometime in the future so we can get into another beautiful conversation about it. I just love talking with you so much.
Thank you, Peter. I look forward to it.
And thank you. And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew, Progressive Radio Network. And I can be reached at peter@heartriver.org. And thank you so much for listening.